It's the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Famous Monsters of Filmland Magazine.
Welcome to the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Forrest J. Ackerman's classic magazine that started it all back in 1958. Often imitated, never duplicated, we are more than just monsters. We cover sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and all kinds of genre pop culture, living up to Forrest's classic roots while staying current and ahead of the curve. I'm David Weiner, editor of Famous Monsters, and with me today is Caroline Stevenson, our media and promotions guru.
Hello!
And FM podcast producer Cameron Hathaway.
Now, if a streaker runs past a werewolf, does he transform because he sees the full moon?
The audience transforms in horror, kind of like they did in the Oscars, and David Niven talks about his shortcomings. Yes, watch that clip. It'll all make sense. So we are talking about werewolves today.
Oh.
Woo woo.
There we go.
I was expecting the biggest werewolf fan in the room to be like, oh my God, freaking out.
You know what? I'm trying to keep it cool. I'm trying to be an adult right now, and it's very hard because I'm so excited for this podcast right now, but
you've got your professional cap on. Just all right, we're talking about werewolves.
This is science.
Yes.
Caroline is our resident werewolf fiend. She loves, loves, loves werewolves.
Yes, I do.
There's not a day that she goes by that she does not remind us how much she loves werewolves and knows everything that there is to know about werewolves. Is that a true statement?
I think so.
And there's Werewolf Wednesday on the social media pages every Wednesday. So
there is. Yeah, it's a day I created for me, for myself, and for the werewolves of the world to get their
fix.
Why do you love werewolves so much? What is it about werewolves compared to other monsters that really, 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 really deeply affect you and move you?
I think it's definitely a combination between, I always loved wolves growing up. They're one of my favorite animals. And then it definitely has to do with sort of the emotional, the idea that you could become something else. Mm-hmm. And you could, for those of us, I'm going to get a little deep, little backstory. For those of us that, may have been, picked on in school. Mm-hmm. And, this idea that you could become something stronger and something meaner and go mess those bullies up pretty bad.
Well, if anything, though, with that logic, you would be hated even more because you were this horrible, hideous monster that went around killing
people. Yeah, oh, I don't think she cares. She would
ginger,
be feared.
It'd be Ginger Snaps. Dude, she got pretty popular, all around school. She just everyone was picking up what she was putting down. And they didn't mess with her.
So
that was kind of...
So it's sort of revenge fantasy. Basically, a werewolf is your spirit animal.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes more... It's a little bit deeper than
this is very personal, everybody.
I know.
Clearly, this is not just conversation.
We're
this is
a lot more
deep-rooted here.
But, it's not just about, getting back at people, but also, being able to really connect with nature. It sort of varies from the stories that I'm reading. Some of them are a little bit less about the violence and more about, you become this creature and you go out in the woods and you hunt and you run as a pack and, connecting with nature and sort of the pack mentality and stuff like that always seemed, just really, really cool to me. So,
well, we all love werewolves at Famous Monsters Magazine. We're huge fans. And if you haven't noticed in the last two issues, we've covered two very, very popular werewolf movies. In number 284, we did An American Werewolf in London, celebrating its 35th anniversary. And in the current issue out now, we celebrate The Howling, also celebrating its 35th anniversary. Hey, those movies came out in the same year.
Pretty so good.
81 was a good year for werewolf movies because there was also Wolfen as well.
Wolfen, yeah, exactly.
Albert. I would like a time machine to go back and just live in that time period so I could just see all those movies.
Go see
back.
Movies with Albert Finney, go see the Wolfen, and then see American Werewolf and then see Howling. Actually, I think it's the other way around though in terms of their release. But we had a wonderful time talking with the quintet that we reunited for the last issue of An American Werewolf in London. We had Rick Baker. We had John Landis. We had David Naughton. We had Jenny Agutter. And we had Griffin Dunn all talking about their experiences in that movie.
It was a really cool article. You guys definitely check out 284. It's on CaptainCode.com.
And even at the Silver Screen Fest, we had three of the five. And that was an awesome discussion as well. Like, that was a packed theater for that reunion.
It was amazing having Landis, Naughton, and Baker talking about that movie after screening it fresh for the audience. It was really fun up in Santa Rosa.
Do you have that picture framed yet of you moderating that panel?
Well, you know, it was so great. It was a bit surreal because that's a movie that I've absolutely loved since I was a kid. The Howling, which is in the current issue now, I got an opportunity to sit down with director Joe Dante, and I also got to talk with Dee Wallace, who's the star of that film. And that film is very, very interesting because not only did it come out in the year that American Werewolf came out, but they kind of shared some craftspeople, or tried to. Rick Baker, who had wanted to work on American Werewolf for years and years and years after Landis planted it in his brain, he had to wait a decade. And over that decade, he had worked on some amazing contraptions, change-o heads, he called them, amazing designs for what he wanted to be a two-legged werewolf. And then Landis said, well, we're still getting the money. We haven't gotten financing, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen. So here comes Joe Dante, and he says, hey, we're making a werewolf movie. I hear you're really good at werewolves. How would you like to work for us? And Baker basically said, well, absolutely. I've been working on this for 10 years. I'll jump at the chance. And so, ironically, it turns out that right when he was ready to go and start doing things for The Howling and started working on The Howling in terms of pre-production and pre-conceptualization, then Landis came along and said, hey, I got the financing. Let's do this. And then Baker found himself in a bit of a pickle. I talked to Joe Dante about this little situation that came up. And he also talked about the design of his own werewolf and the transformation effects and how that all came to pass involving Rob Bottin, who was a protege of Rick Baker's. Here's a little clip. Now, of course, I've talked to Rick Baker, and I know that he was involved in the project.
I went to Rick first because we knew that Rick liked werewolf movies, and he'd always wanted to make one. And John Landis was supposed to do a werewolf movie, but he had never come up with the money. And so since that had never happened, we went to Rick and said, you know, how about doing our picture? And he said, okay. And then, of course, once John found out about it, he somehow managed to procure the money. And he went to Rick and he said, you promised. And so Rick had to bow out. But he did do some remarkable video tests for us mm-hmm. that were really creepy. Not, as it turned out, that practical to do on film. And anyway, he left Rob Bottin in charge, and Rob did, I think, a great job. And that was really his first big break, because Ridley Scott saw the movie and liked Rob's work, and he went on to do Legend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's spectacular work. Rick said that he stayed on, I don't know to what degree.
He gets a credit.
That name. Yeah, consultant.
Yeah.
But that Rob was his protege, and he kind of...
It's true. It's true. I'm sure he helped him a lot. Sure Rob asked him questions, and he was very good about answering. Sure. But in the meantime, he was also doing, you know, his own thing.
What was your involvement creatively in terms of the design of the werewolf?
We went back to woodcuts. We wanted to make them look like woodcuts, and some of the woodcuts are in the movie that we had seen and said, "Look, this is really what they should look like." And we wanted to stay away from the Lon Chaney Jr. version not because we didn't love it, but because we didn't want to do. And there's a reason why he only has a head and hands and feet, is because they didn't want to do a whole body.
Sure.
And on the poster for the Wolfman, the original, they did a hairy body for him as if he's naked for the movie. And for various reasons, that wasn't going to work. And that was sort of the go-to way of doing it, because it was, you know, more economical. And when Kerwin Matthews did it in The Boy Who Cried Werewolf, it was the same kind of a deal. And I was a teenage werewolf. All those movies were based. They would stay in their clothes, and they would have hairy hands and a hairy head. We loved that stuff, but we didn't want to do it that way. And so this was a little more primal to be able to say, okay, this is a really animal. This mm-hmm. guy's turned into an animal. The design was really kind of dictated by the woodcuts.
Mm-hmm.
But the transformation itself, was that something that you kind of said, you know, I like what Rick has done? You give
Rob, well, the transformation changed. Well, what Rick had done, Rick did it all in one shot. And that it was really great. But when we went to the completion bond, the first question is, you know, we told him our excited plans for doing it all in one shot. And he said, what if you can't get it in one shot? And I said, well, I guess we'll do it in cuts. He said, that's what I wanted to hear. Or we wouldn't have gotten the money. Yeah. And as it turned out, later we discovered when CGI came in and there were shows like Manimal, that watching a person change all at one shot wasn't really all that exciting.
Yeah.
And you lose the value of cutting. You lose the whole thing about movies, which is that you get to have reaction shots.
Right.
And so when we did the scene in the movie where the first transformation, which is way too long because AFCO Embassy showed it to the exhibitors and the exhibitors flipped out over it and they said, you can't change it. So we had to keep it the way.
You couldn't
make it shorter. No. We futzed around with it. I mean, we discovered that when mistakes were made, like something would pop because the bladder broke or whatever, and we put a sound effect on it. It looked like it was intentional. So there's a lot of stuff in that scene that is, you know, there's speed changes. There's all sorts of weird stuff.
Right.
And it's all great stuff. The only problem is it's too long.
Right.
And we showed the picture to there was on our same floor there was a casting agent and they were doing some commercials and the kids were coming in and we said, oh, let's show the kids the transformation and see what they think. And so we brought a kid and watched the movie all and he's watching and he says, why don't she run away? And it was like, of course, why doesn't she run away? Because she's paralyzed with fear.
She's paralyzed. But we need an audience. We exactly. need to live vicariously through someone who's not going to run
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
One of the great things about The Howling is that when you look back at it, it ages very interestingly. It's kind of a time capsule. It looks amazing, and compared to movies these days, it definitely takes its time to reveal its wolves. It probably takes about an hour before you see anything, and it's a very, very slow burn. It's much more of a psychological tale that manifests itself into, well, there's a bunch of werewolves. It's not in your imagination. It's very, very cool. One of the racier scenes in this movie is that campfire scene where Chris Stone and Elizabeth Brooks, they get together and...
they love transforms in more ways than one.
Yes, and it gets a little hairy and howling. The Howling finally gets its title. You know how in every movie, at one point you're looking for that point where they're going to say, oh, this is the title of the movie as we say it in the dialogue. Well, perhaps arguably in that movie, that's when you get the Howling title.
And more appropriate, you know, it's one their primal urges and all that.
So exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a very racy scene. It's a very memorable scene, and it's a very pivotal scene in the movie. But it's also an interesting thing in terms of the behind-the-scenes story with that, because Chris Stone, who gets it on with Elizabeth Brooks in that movie, well, he was engaged to the star, Dee Wallace.
They were
a couple. And so here's this scene, and Dee Wallace is also very known, self-proclaimed, gets very deep into her characters and often gets lost in the psychology of her characters. And it's a little hard to pull her out sometimes. And that's what allows her to give such amazing, amazing performances. Well, here, everybody was a little bit nervous because they're like, Dee, are you going to be around for this shoot tonight?
Gosh, I can't even imagine.
Are you going to be hanging out on set watching this? Please, please don't. Well, I had a wonderful opportunity to talk to Dee and talk all about the movie, and I did bring up this scene and the sequence, and I was kind of curious about what she was thinking when this was all going down, and here's what she had to say about it.
Now, of course, there's a pretty racy scene by the fire.
Yeah.
Were you guys were engaged or were you married when you?
We were engaged.
You were engaged.
Yeah.
How did you handle that?
I went to the town, had dinner, and got drunk with a friend. Actually, I think they sprung Gigi, my makeup artist. Anyway, they created somebody to take me to town, right? And I remember Joe came up to me the day before, and he said, well, you know, Dee, you know, the the crew really loves you, and they know your, you know, relationship with Chris. And quite frankly, they're all kind of worried about the scene tomorrow and wondering if you're going to be there. I said, hell no, I'm not going to be there. And he looked at me and went, oh, thank God. You know, but I am, I went into town and got a little bombed and came back and waited up. And I think Chris holed in at 4 or 5 in the morning. And I said, well, so how was it? And he said, Pupper, he used to call me Pupper. He said, Pupper, we froze our butts off. You know, go back to sleep. Nothing happened. And I totally trusted him.
That scene was definitely racy when I saw that in the theater as a kid, and I was clearly too young to watch it.
Oh my gosh, how old?
Well, in 81, let's see, if we're going to put our cards on the table, I was, well, how old was I? I was 13. I was 13 years old.
Oh, you were a baby. Oh my gosh.
No, well,
did your parents take you to go see The Howling?
Absolutely not. No, no. It's all about asking people to let you in if you buy them popcorn.
Ah.
What? That's a thing.
That's a thing.
Or you pay a homeless person to buy your ticket for you or something like
that.
Oh
my God, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're old enough to be out and your parents, they know you're going to be home at a certain point. And you say, oh, I'm going out with friends. And then you go straight to the theater down the block.
Friends were Joe Dante.
We had a wonderful theater. It was called Scarsdale Plaza. It was in New York where I grew up. And Scarsdale Plaza had a 99-cent theater. Mm. And when every movie came and went, right before it went and disappeared, it went to Scarsdale Plaza. And it ran for 1 week. And it was a dirty, dusty print. And I got to see a new movie every single week. This probably is extremely formative of my life because I saw everything there. That's where I saw American Werewolf. I saw Blues Brothers. I saw Caddyshack. I saw The Howling. I saw Frank Langella as Dracula and John Badham's Dracula. And the one movie I always regret missing was Alien. I missed it by 1 week, and I remember my mom's like, no, that is going to give you nightmares. And I said, no, I know everything about the movie. I have the comic. I have the photo novel. I have the behind-the-scenes book. I know everything. There are going to be no surprises. And she said, no. And then the next week when that movie was gone, my dad looks at me and he says, so, did you want to see that Alien movie?
It was almost like a bad joke.
And
like,
your heart falls out on the ground.
No, his heart burst forth from his chest right. Like an alien. But he didn't know it because he didn't see the movie.
Those were the days when it was not on video in 4 months or 3 months. Man. And so, but it was a pleasant consequence was the movie that was playing next week was that John Badham's Dracula movie with Frank Langella. So,
well, going back to The Howling really quick, what was your like first reaction, like seeing just all of a sudden just like, oh, by the way, they're about to get it on, and you're kind of coming to that realization like, oh, okay, and then it transforms, like it's supposed to be something passionate and primal, then all of a sudden, werewolf! So like, what was that experience like?
Was it
mixed emotions?
It was an amazing movie. It was an amazing movie. But you know what? I think I had been prepped for monsters and nudity by watching Roger Corman's Humanoids from the Deep, which came out the year before. And by the time I saw The Howling, I had seen it on cable every single time it played. It was appointment viewing. If you watch that movie, you'll see it's a total sexploitation movie, but it's actually got really good looking monsters. So it's obviously a quick aside.
Shout out to Roger Corman. He celebrated his birthday.
Yeah. Just turned 90 years old.
Connection with this movie and Roger Corman too.
So well, that's the thing. Exactly. Joe Dante, it came from the school of Roger Corman. Joe Dante directed Piranha for Corman and worked on a bunch of other films and edited for him. And that was basically his film school was the Roger Corman School of Filmmaking. And if you read the article in the new Famous Monsters magazine, he talks a little bit about what he learned from Roger Corman that he applied to making The Howling.
But to answer your question, I remember watching that scene, and of course, my pulse quickened quite a bit. It was quite good, and that's why it's, you know, I look back at it so fondly, because for me, if you know, it might be a little creaky with age, but it still kind of had it all. It had amazing transformations. It had very atmospheric tension and psychology there, and it had a good scene of full frontal nudity that I definitely responded to. It had Dee Wallace, you know, E.T. E.T.'s mom, and you know, when she wasn't being I think Cujo came a little bit after
that. Yeah, a little bit later, yeah.
You know, but she wasn't being victimized by canine creatures.
She was more accepting of it.
Exactly. So it kind of had everything for me, you know, and slim pickings, you know, you can't You know, so it really was a great film for me, and that's why I look back at it so fondly. What did you guys think of that scene?
Well, I thought it was interesting because, ooh, like, that scene, like, reminded me, there were, like, three different types of transformations throughout. Like, there was the stop motion of the werewolves at certain points, like when it was their full figures and whatnot. There was, by the fireplace, it was obviously, like, animated, like 2D animation.
Right.
And then the actual practical makeup effects as, like, the third. So, like, there was all sorts of different, like, it was a mixed bag, but at the same time, it all really worked, and it really helped you stay in this world that Dante created, and just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, for someone who really loves werewolves. I loved the movie, and I always appreciate werewolf films that are different from one another, and to have, you know, if you put The Howling next to Wolfen and American Werewolf, like, three werewolf movies come out in the same year that are completely different films. And I'm a big fan of a slow burn, and I like, you know, there was definitely the payoff in the end with that great practical effects transformation, which I still really love. I think it holds up, you know, even today. You know, unfortunately, you don't see a lot of practical effects werewolf transformations, which, if any filmmakers are listening,
get on
for the love of God, please make a good werewolf movie with cool practical effects transformations. I'm also okay with some CGI. Like, I'm totally on board with CGI. Just make a good werewolf movie right now. Anyway, that's my tiny rant. But no, like, you know, I like the psychological aspects, and I liked, you know, that it was a colony, it was a pack, it was, you know, because you have American Werewolf and there's just the one, and now we see this sort of pack mentality, and, you know, I think that's why that scene, the, you know, little sexy scene,
right,
is so, like, was really cool to me, because it was like, there is more to the werewolves than just senseless violence. There's connection, and there's, you know, feeling.
Well, there's animal attraction, and if you think about it, it's of the many, many werewolf movies that had come before it, which aren't that many, and even the ones that have come afterwards. This one, it really zeroes in on sort of that primal animal attraction. And plays it out literally, you know, in a scene, in a sex scene. Yeah. And it obviously speaks volumes about not necessarily the actual practical sex that you don't really see and is implied in this movie for the most part, because of shadows and strategic lighting and stuff like that. It's one of those things where, you know, I think John Sayles, who wrote the script, he was really gunning for the psychology of not only these werewolves and the scene, but of sort of these werewolves and the scene set in the 70s, where you have these sort of the colony where they have all the werewolves. It's all about self-help groups and betterment, and also dealing, you know, looking inward. That's what happened with the 70s. As people started thinking, well, now that we've rebelled and celebrated, now we've got some problems that we have to finally address in our own psyches. And now maybe if we go to an enclave and collect with other people, we can get therapeutic about it. And that's really what sort of inspired the script and the storyline as an excuse to make a werewolf movie. It didn't go so far as going to the cult extremes that the 60s experienced, mm-hmm. you know, with Manson and the family and so on. It sort of had a taste of that as well, because that was still very fresh in the 70s as they were, you know, transitioning into the 80s when this film was made. So now we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to dive into the world of werewolves. Yikes!
I'm so excited.
Do you love werewolves? More importantly, do you enjoy reading about all things werewolves? Then do yourself a favor and check out Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine, issues 284 and 285, on sale now. We celebrate the 35th anniversaries of both An American Werewolf in London and The Howling, and interview the directors and its stars. Get those issues and more at CaptainCo.com. Famous Monsters and Werewolves, it's going to be a howling good time. Werewolf t-shirts also available. Sorry, we don't sell silver bullets.
So a lot of people, when they think of werewolves, there's all these recent wonderful films, but of course it really goes back to those wonderful, wonderful Universal Monsters and Universal Studios films. And The Wolfman, 1941's The Wolfman, The Wolf Space Man. that Lon Chaney Jr. as Larry Talbot, you've got Bela Lugosi and Claude Rains. It really set the stage with makeup and what people thought wolfmen can be, and that a lycanthrope can transform into something hairy and nefarious and animalistic and scary. But, you know, it brings forth a question. What's your question, Cameron?
My question is, what is the difference between a wolfman and a werewolf? Like, they're the same thing, right? They both transform under the full moon?
So, I mean, this is a thing that's come up many a time on our Facebook page and social media. Technically, they are the same thing. I mean, they're both werewolves. It's just more about appearance. Mm-hmm. So, like, the wolfman is essentially much more man than wolf, which you see in the 1941, and you also see in Curse of the Werewolf and Werewolf in London. You know, it's a sort of a hairy man face. He'll have the claws. He could have, you know, a little bit of rearranged facial structure, mm-hmm. but he is mostly just a hairy man.
So Robin Williams without a shirt is what we're thinking.
Yes.
If anything, it's like almost like dog breeds where you have some with, they're all dogs, but some have squished in faces and the others actually have snouts.
Snouts, yes.
Okay.
All
right.
I will say personally, I am a fan of the bipedal, much more wolf, much, you know, they can be as big as 10 feet tall, and wow. They are...
Like the Howling Wolves.
The Howling Wolves. I love the Howling Wolves. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Rick Baker's Kessler Wolf. Mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely fantastic and terrifying and amazing. But I generally prefer my two-legged werewolves, which, you know, Dog Soldiers is my favorite film, and they did such a fantastic mm-hmm. job with those wolf suits. And if we could just have more like that...
Well, it's one of those things where you, I look back at that movie, The Wolfman, and that scared me as a kid. And, well, I was very young. I was a kid. I was watching
baby.
That.
I like how you're just like judging him, like, come on, grow up. Oh,
and it's funny, though, you look back at it, and most of The Wolfman is he kind of creeps up behind you, behind a tree, mm-hmm. and is about to attack. And that's what's scary. And then when he goes to attack you, he just kind of misses just a little bit. I mean, that's more right. kind of the Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein variety, you know, that's one of my favorite movies, Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, simply because they take this trope and completely make fun of it. And basically, Lon Chaney Jr. gets to play Larry Talbot and the Wolfman yet again, except this time, every time he transforms, they all think he's on a bender and he drank too much.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Or
no, I remember that. I saw that movie growing up, too. Yeah,
it's one of my favorites. It's absolutely, and, you know, they're like, he's saying, no, you don't understand it. At midnight, I'm going to change. I'm going to transform. And, you know, Costello's like, yeah, you and 1,000 other guys are going to do that. So it's definitely one of my favorites. It's funny, moving on, skipping around a bit, talking about a wonderful transformation that you'd like to see. That's practical. I think what's a very interesting transformation is the updated Wolfman that Rick Baker worked on. The Benicio del Toro one. Yeah, that was pretty much, it came from Universal, and it was universally panned for the most part by critics. But there are definite, I think for every bad movie, there are definite virtues. And if anything, if the story was kind of a mess structurally, I think what's great about that film is that one transformation scene when he's in the what is it, the asylum chair, demonstration room for all the doctors
and
to
the
sort
guy's
of
guys like poking at him.
Yeah, and he's like, "I'm gonna kill every one of you." And it's, I think that's great, because if you look at also the story behind that is, you know, they brought Rick Baker back and they said, "All right, you made the quintessential transformation, you know, with American Werewolf in 1981. Now come back and top yourself. Will you do it?" And he said yes. And despite meddling by studio heads, who's, you know, studio executives who said, "Well, I have a good idea. Let's do it entirely different from what you're proposing," which was a major source of frustration for Baker.
Why do we need you here anyway?
Yeah. He told me a wonderful story about how he was sitting in front of a particular executive who said, "All right, well, you know, we've got some budget issues here, and I see there's a bill for all this hair. Why do we have so much hair on this movie?" And Baker looked at him and just said, "Are you kidding?" And there was a preview poster of the Wolfman behind the guy. And he got up and he walked up to this poster and he said, "Here is the Wolfman poster. Now I'm going to cover the part that says wolf. Okay, it says the man. Now I'm going to take my hand off and it says the Wolfman. We are making a movie about a Wolfman.
Oh,
wolves have hair. Now, will you let me do my job, please?"
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine the frustration of, like, having to work with people. Like,
oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, you know.
Executive going, like, I don't think I got it. Could you explain it to me again? Yeah.
Yeah.
One more time. So I think that transformation is very unique from you're looking at the perspective of it's Rick Baker trying to sort of one-up himself or at least evolve in the transformation. And so I thought that transformation was even more painful to watch than the one in American Werewolf, you know, with the fingers snapping and crunching and they're the I think everything was turned up to 11 on that one. And even though the movie itself might have not been so great, I think that transformation is worth a definite revisit.
No, it was spectacular. I definitely love my werewolf transformation scenes to have lots of bone popping and screaming. And
you actually did a list for the last issue of Famous Monsters. Who? What was that? What was on that list? And why? Give us a quick breakdown.
Okay. One of the shows I've been, you know, watching recently, trying to keep up with, is Hemlock Grove,
Eli Roth produced that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Such a great story, and it's, you know, totally backed in, like, gypsy mysticism and all this really cool stuff. And so what I love is they treat their werewolves with really old, like, mythologies that, like, go back to, like, medieval times. And this idea that the wolf is literally under your skin. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you pull... The hair doesn't grow out of the body, but you shed your skin and then the wolf's underneath. And they've done some really cool scenes, you know, with the wolf's snout coming out of his mouth, which kind of is a nod back to Company of Wolves,
right.
Also so good.
and there's also practical transformation.
Yes, also fantastic practical. And then another great scene where another character is like a vampire-esque gypsy sort of creature, and he actually has to rip open the mouth of the wolf, and then the human is inside, like, oof, fully. And it's so great, like, he just pulls him out of there. So fantastic. A couple other ones I really liked. It's short, but the werewolves in Trick or Treat, all the femme fatales are pretty spectacular. Again, that's another shedding of the skin to reveal the wolf underneath. I think that was actually practical too. I'm gonna have to quickly go back to my list because there's so many good ones. Being Human is another, and more the BBC version.
Sure.
Just about how he describes the transformation, because he really gets into, like, Like, no human should survive this.
Sure.
But, like, it's the werewolf in you that keeps you alive because, like, the first thing to go is, like, your vocal cords because you would be screaming from the pain the whole time if you could. But they're reforming.
Mm.
So that one's pretty spectacular. I will also give a shout out. You know a lot of people give Van Helsing a lot of flack.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it at the right time and I was on board 100%.
Oh, okay.
I love the monsters. I'm not gonna lie.
How old were you when you saw that?
I was in my young teens.
Okay.
I saw it in the theater, I think maybe 7 times.
Wow.
Like, I can't explain.
Monster
exactly.
packed movie. It had everything.
Like, I was just so on board and I really did, even though they were CGI werewolves, I really liked the werewolves because it was, you know, again, going back to the old sort of mythologies of werewolves and they were big and bipedal and angry and scary and...
I was angry at all the CGI, but continue.
There was a lot of CGI.
But I always thought it was a very good concept, and I know that they've been wanting to try and remake that again. At one point, Tom Cruise was attached to a remake of that to play Van Helsing. But...
Well, now it's a television series, right? Or it's being developed as one with like a female
lead? Yeah,
yes, it is.
Sci-fi.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe we'll see other werewolves.
That's
other
a great opportunity.
Too.
You can write in for some practical werewolf transformations.
Be like, hey, guys. Hey.
Now, I have a question. Is Manimal, does that count in our conversation? There was a TV show in the was it around 1980 or so.
Her face right now is
actually, it was early
80s. 1980s? What was that?
It was in the early 80s, now that I think about it. It was probably around 82 or 83 as a direct response to how amazing American Werewolf was. And some studio execs said, we need a guy who changes into an animal every week and will use the transformation effects from American Werewolf.
It sounds like a good idea.
Manimal.
I've never seen it. Was so it any good?
No, it was pretty awful. And it was pretty funny, too. But I remember tuning in at least a couple times because I wanted to, you know, you wanted anything that you could get that was even close to being anything like American Werewolf in London. And so the fact that they had perfected these effects to a certain degree where they were doing it on TV now, I was curious. I had that curiosity factor. You know what? Go to YouTube. That should be plenty. I wouldn't suggest actually sitting through an entire episode unless you're a bit masochistic.
I was going to say, it kind of sounds like in True Blood, they had werewolves, they had werepanthers, and then they also had like shifters, which could transform into any animal. Like it would just happen, though. Like there wasn't any like really cool transformations.
Oh, right. Yeah. He was just a little
like he
little
could
beagle.
Just a little bit of everything. Like if it was like the X-Men, he was Rogue, where he could just like think of an animal or whatnot and change into it.
I also need to say something really quick because this has been a point of conflict for many years and on many social media posts and websites. The Twilight wolves are not werewolves. And I'm not saying that in my opinion they're not werewolves. I'm saying in the story it says they are not werewolves. They are shapeshifters.
Uh-huh.
So that's why their transformations are different. So
why don't they shapeshift into anything else?
Because it's like one spirit animal. Like you bond with one animal and then you can shapeshift with that animal.
Well,
that's
I don't think anyone's going to call you out on that because that means they would actually have to pick up the book and read it. And I don't know anyone who wants to do that.
You
can't argue with the legions of fans who are just not in this room right
there
now.
There we go. There we go.
Although you should all check out our April Fool's cover.
April Fool's? No, that's an actual third cover.
Apologies now to all those who love Twilight. It's obviously easy to make fun of Twilight, and to each their own. And but we poked a little fun at Twilight by making it our April Fool's cover.
I had so much fun.
I loved it. It was so good.
Actually, there's another werewolf film that's not quite a werewolf film, and I'm just going to bring it up because if people haven't seen it, I really want people to seek it out. It's called Brotherhood of the Wolf. It's a French film, so beware.
Oh, I heard good
not
things.
Only werewolves, but subtitles.
But the French. Yeah.
But it's actually don't expect werewolves, but expect mystery. It's a period action adventure where it's based on an actual true story of a creature that was roaming the woods in the sticks of France.
That would be the Beast of Gavaudan, right?
Wow, I think you might know that.
And bam. Then, knowledge dropped.
It's basically these men are tasked to find it and kill it, whatever it may be, and they get embroiled in a local conspiracy while they're trying to figure out what exactly is this creature. And it's really, really well done.
Wow.
It's really well done. It's action-packed. Mark Dacascos, who played the Crow at one point, he's in there, and he kicks serious ass in that. Vincent Cassel is there. And the beautiful Monica Bellucci is in it as well.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's a well-cast film, and it's a really good film. And I will just say tangentially now, don't expect werewolves at every corner, but it's definitely interesting to follow this storyline and see where it goes, because they all believe that it is a wolf that is killing everyone.
Werewolf? There, wolf.
A little Young Frankenstein reference for everybody. Now, of course, you know, werewolves, there's werewolves in comedy as well. I mean, did you guys see Teen Wolf? Or Teen Wolf 2?
Back in the day.
Oh, that Teen Wolf. I was thinking of the MTV show. I was like, that's not
you know
really
me,
comedic.
You know me. I live in the 80s. There might be some MTV show that takes Teen Wolf seriously, but I'm talking about Michael J. Fox and Jason Bateman as werewolves.
Yes.
You know, where that if you think about it, it's all about puberty. You become a werewolf. There's big transformations, and you grow hair. Well, that's what that took into a literal standpoint and made it a big comedy, but it didn't have anything to literally do with puberty. But it was pretty funny.
It was a good one.
I'm a bit taken aback that you're not so enthusiastic about the Teen Wolf movies.
It was just one of those things where he kind of more looked like a monkey. and I gotta be honest, I love all animals. All animals are great, but I have this weird thing with primates. And a lot of times, and this is across all mediums, people will make werewolves look more ape-like. And it's like, you've just taken my favorite thing and turned it into my least favorite thing.
Well, it's kind of funny when you look at that last scene in The Howling. And Dee Wallace changes into a werewolf. She said very specifically to Joe Dante, she said, if I look like one of those scary, horrifying things, I'm not going to do the movie. So they had to think about, well, how do we change her into a werewolf, but we've got to make it a little softer around the edges. And they basically turned her into like a little puppy schnauzer type of thing.
Yeah, like almost reminded me of like a Wookiee almost as well.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, what a pretty Wookiee. Oh.
And no matter how you felt.
Kill the pretty Wookiee!
She transforms on live television during her newscast. And the greatest thing, instead of the world being horrified by this transformation, you had these two little kids saying, Mom, Dad, look, the news lady just turned into a werewolf. Werewolf! It's such a great ending to that movie. Now, one movie that we haven't talked about that I'm kind of curious about your opinions is the Underworld series.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a whole, you know, you've got vampires versus werewolves in Twilight, but they're not werewolves. They're shapeshifters, I've just been informed.
Yep.
Well, now you've got the vampires versus lycanthropes in Underworld and that whole series. Are you guys fans of those? Have you followed that?
You know, I saw a couple of them in theaters. I mean, they were just, you know, fun movies that you saw with your friends. I mean, I wasn't going in with a pad and pencil going like, no, that's not right about werewolf or lycanthrope culture. But like, I mean, it was intense. Like, you have two of these like most iconic movie monsters going toe-to-toe with like great special effects. So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, overall, I had fun as an action adventure movie. I'd love to hear Caroline's thoughts on the matter.
No, I actually, I liked him a lot. You know, I thought it was, you know, a fun mashup of sort of the Matrix and these gothic monsters, and the werewolves were really cool. It did take me a little bit to get on board with the design, mm-hmm. but what I really, really liked when they came out with Rise of the Lycans, and they basically sort of explain the designs, and you see William was the original wolf, mm-hmm. and he is the big gray one, which I think you see in the second one.
Okay.
But so when you find out when he bites people, they become wolves and they can't change back. And so they look more wolf-like. But mm-hmm. when Lucien is born, like, he looks more human. So all of the werewolves that come from him look just a little bit different. And I thought that was a really cool, like, just a creative, like, piece of whatever to throw in your movie. Like, this is why they look like that, and this is why they look like that. And ultimately, I think those were a lot of, like, the suits were practical, and they looked really, really nice. I watched a lot of the special features and, you know, the actors on stilts and putting them together and the different, like, muscles in the face and the jaw so that they could snarl. And, like, it was really cool. I do enjoy those movies.
One of my, like, favorite instances of a werewolf in a movie, I grew up loving the Harry Potter films. Mm-hmm. And so when the third one came out, The Prisoner of Azkaban, oh, Caroline's not happy with this. Apologies ahead of time. I really enjoyed the transformation because it was really freaky. Like,
yeah,
seeing
he
it
looked
transform,
in pain.
And then, yeah, and then just, like, the one moment where they're like, Professor Lupin, are you okay? And then he, like, looks at them with, like, these just evil-looking eyes and then just starts, like, to snarl. I'm like, oh, my God. I had the opportunity to go to Leavesden Studios a couple of years ago on a vacation. And sure enough, in, like, the creature, like, workshop portion of the studios, they had, like, a full-blown werewolf.
Oh, wow.
Lupin's werewolf.
That's very cool.
And it was cool because it still kind of gave me shivers looking at it. It's like, oh, it's, like, right there behind a glass case. And then they had, like, a working, like, a smaller, like, head showing, like, how they could work the puppet and whatnot, too.
So
it was really cool. Yeah.
I have to say, with a name like Lupin, I was so surprised that he turned into a werewolf. I did not see that coming for a mile.
Snape tried warning all of them, and only Hermione Granger got it. She's like, a werewolf, Professor. It transforms under the moonlight.
I was gobsmacked. Absolutely gobsmacked. You know, it's very cool. Actually, another thing that it's very important to mention is that in our current issue, there's a very cool werewolf comic called Cry Havoc. And that's very new, and that's in its current run.
There's only three issues out right now, but mm-hmm. I mean, already, like, after issue one, people were getting on board with this. I mean, Cy Spurr, Ryan Kelly, great artist. I have only read the first issue, but from what I've read so far about just, like, their take on werewolves mm-hmm. and just the different way they approach werewolves, it seems really interesting because it's obvious this woman's been bit, and she's being used as almost like a weapon, but she thinks they're going to try to help her, this organization she's with, like, get it out of her.
It's sort of basically like werewolves, lesbians, and war-torn Middle East.
Yeah.
All mixed up in one, and it's very interesting.
It's a very niche, demographic they're going for. No. But if Holly was here, she could...
To all those war-torn lesbians who are also werewolves, we think that this is the book for you.
Excellent. Also on that note of comics and werewolves, I mean, Broken Moon from American Gothic Press. I mean, not to toot our own horn here, but, like, we have some amazing depictions of werewolves by Nat Jones. And it's just, the battles they get into, like, spoiler alert, they battle vampires and Frankenstein's army.
Pretty cool.
And limbs, fangs, and fur is flying, and it's amazing.
Nat Jones did a really nice job with his... Hmm. With the werewolves.
Volume 1, available on CaptainCo.com.
Another werewolf comic that's really good, if, you know, you guys are looking for something, Robert Kirkman and Jason Howard did The Astounding Wolfman, which I started collecting that, you know, obviously right when it came out, which I think I was still in high school. So it's been a couple years, but really great. It's sort of, you know, Batman meets the Wolfman, this rich business owner gets bitten by a werewolf on a family camping trip.
Right? Yeah.
And then basically decides to use his power for good and becomes a superhero, and there are other superheroes involved. And if you guys follow
Invincible,
he makes a couple cameos, and Astounding Wolfman makes a couple cameos in his comic. But it was just such a fun take. And I always appreciate, like I said, different werewolf stories. And so I kind of like it when people embrace the werewolf and kind of go with it in a different way.
And my favorite part, I'm sorry to cut you off, were the gauntlets where it would attract the moonlight and, like, add to his powers. Like, that was like, that's a really cool concept. I really enjoyed that.
There were a lot of ideas. And I actually had the pleasure of meeting Robert Kirkman at WonderCon, not this year, but
your
2015, mm-hmm. and asked him if maybe there would be any more Astounding Wolfman, and he said he might make some appearances in Invincible, but
doesn't he make an appearance in Walking Dead? Yeah. Oh, wait, no, that's Negan. Never mind.
Boo.
Oh.
For a second, I was like, he makes what?
What?
Wait a minute,
they transferred.
What do you know?
What I do know is that we also did a very cool piece in the new issue of Famous Monsters about the monsters of Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of an interesting story where they had the comics code for a very long time that sort of restricted actual monsters to be in comics because they thought that was too scary for kids. Yeah. But in the early 70s, that changed, and that just opened up the floodgates for a lot of amazing, amazing comics. And, of course, in addition to, like, Frankenstein and Dracula and the Mummy.
Yeah,
Morbius, the Vampire, who's one of definitely my favorites. You've got Werewolf by Night, and you've got Man-Wolf. You've got a bunch of folks. So, you know, what's your take on those? Did you read those comics?
Yeah, I actually love those characters. Entire Werewolf by Night. Like compendium.
Yes.
Because of course
why am I not surprised? That's great.
I'd like to think I own all of the Werewolf comics. They're really fun. They're really fun stories. Werewolf by Night is cool because, you know, like many superhero stories, it kind of varies depending on who's writing them. Sometimes he's, you know, a little more of a good guy. Sometimes he can control himself less. So he's, you know, killing people. And, that's a fun story to check out. Man-Wolf is just a classic. Stan Lee, I believe.
That's J. Jonah Jameson's son, is mm-hmm. it not? What happened?
Dun, dun,
space!
Dun. He went to space, went to the moon, basically gets affected by the moon and becomes Man-Wolf.
Simply like that. He wasn't bitten by a moon bug or something like that.
Or a moon wolf.
I don't believe so.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No, it was just a freak accident. And becomes Man-Wolf. Some other great werewolf comics. Batman battles with a werewolf at one point.
Well, is Man-Bat like a werewolf, or is that just something else entirely?
No,
he's fuzzy and wolf-like, but he's a bat, he's a man. And he doesn't qualify at all for this conversation, does he?
No. Man-Bat's so great.
Other than that, you can get a cool toy out of it currently, right?
Yes, actually, which I have a review up on YouTube if you want to learn more about Man-Bat.
Do you have lots of werewolf toys? Do you have select werewolf
oh
toys?
My God,
what werewolf toys
so
do you
many
have?
Werewolf toys. I have the new Rick Baker Wolfman.
Uh-huh.
I have the dog.
What is the new Rick Baker Wolfman? You need to clarify what that means.
It's an action figure. He comes with like the cane and. Like, it's Benicio del Toro, but transformed.
Okay.
It comes with a little stand.
Is that a NECA toy?
I don't know. Hmm. Actually, I know it's not NECA. I don't know who made it, though.
Okay. But it's like, it's a collectible action figure.
It's a collectible action figure.
Okay.
I have the Dog Soldiers action figure, which, fun fact, I learned from the director of Dog Soldiers that he had no idea that they made figures, and he actually had to go out and buy one.
Oh, they didn't tell him.
He had no idea that they made it.
Obviously, merchandise wasn't in the contract, right?
let's see. I got a werewolf creature from Spawn. I've got the people that made the Devilman figures made a line of monstrous figures. They're mm-hmm. all sort of female, and so I have the werewolf, and she's, for some reason, a rock star. She plays the bass.
Of course.
So she's super duper cool and like purpley and furry. And
you think she'd be on vocals? Well, you know.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, she comes with
Werewolves of London. Yeah. Yes,
she comes with a microphone. But I
and
was
her
like,
hair
why isn't
was
she playing, like,
perfect
guitar or something.
Having nothing to do with werewolves, but with Werewolves of London. If you ever see The Color of Money, it's a very cool scene where you see Tom Cruise dancing and singing to that song while he's playing pool and kicking ass playing pool. It's a great little moment.
Well, just pick up Warren Zevon's Excitable Boy album. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one of my all-time favorite albums. It's so great.
We saw a werewolf at Trader Vic's the other day. Oh, wait, that's part of the song.
I saw Lon Chaney walking with the queen doing the Werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with the queen.
Well, there you go. It only made sense to me as an adult what that actually meant.
So now that we're talking about werewolf music, Cat Power actually has a werewolf song that I really like.
Really?
From film to TV to toys and to comics
to now music. Music.
Werewolves permeate a lot more of our culture than I think we realize.
I think so.
And why do you think of it when it comes to movies? I mean, you have Underworld, but that is also it's the Lycans versus the vampires. Why do you think that vampire movies always seem to trump werewolf movies? Vampire movies do very well. Werewolf movies are a lot more spotty with their box office track record, and there are a lot fewer of them than, you know, vampires and now, you know, zombies. Of all the monsters in our culture, werewolves definitely are interesting, popular, and a curiosity, and they're definitely not going away. But when it comes to the box office, they don't do as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. I actually read a really good article from, I believe it was on Blumhouse, where the writer was talking about basically that question, why is it that werewolves don't do that well? And it was, you know, basically it got down to a matter of budget, and that, you know, they can't really put as much effort into, like, what they did. Yeah, in American Werewolf. Uh-huh. And so, you know, they're just not making ones that are, like, I think Uncaged just came out. And, you know, while I heard some good things about the story, the werewolf left something to be desired. Mm. And I feel like that's always kind of what happens is, you know, they'll make a movie and they do their best and the story's good. But then it's like, oh, the werewolves, they just couldn't pull it together as much as fans would have liked.
Plus, I guess it's very hard to compete with The Howling 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, which is the one where the
marsupials.
They become kangaroos, exactly, one, the marsupial. Yeah. Well, we all know that. That's very frightening. We've done our Howling homework.
I've seen that in the $5 bin.
Wow, that's expensive.
Oh, when I worked at a video store, we had a couple of them. Like, we didn't even have the first Howling. We had, like, just the sequels. So it was just like, oh, 3, 5, 7.
I think we'd also be remiss if we don't talk about some of the really, really early ones that are just really fun. I mean, when I think of classic monster movies, you really kind of do go to black and white, and I think everything from, you know, you've got the Wolfman, but you've got Curse of the Werewolf, Werewolf London, you've got I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon wearing that cool 50s jacket. Those movies were worth watching, at least when I was a kid. Just I would wait the entire time just to see that transformation, and I'd always hope it was just like the Wolfman, and that really made a real impact on me when I was a kid. And, yeah, there you go. You know, in our 1975 convention art for the Famous Monsters Convention, we've got Curse of the Werewolf. That's the Oliver Reed one, right? Yeah, he's got to go to the orthodontist.
He's
I think
so happy.
He's having some teeth trouble.
Why am I sharing this T-shirt space with Dracula?
Well, thank you, everyone, for taking the time to listen to us talk on and on about werewolves. I hope that you love werewolves, too, and I hope you go out to get the new issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Oh, wait.
How do you get it? Caroline, where would I go?
CaptainCo.com. There's a button that has the current issue, so you can grab it. I believe also the Rick Baker American Werewolf magazine is still under that collection, so you can find them both.
Oh,
right,
yeah,
in the same place.
Exactly. 285. It's got Harryhausen's Medusa on the cover, and it also has Game of Thrones on the cover. And the previous issue, 284, that has Rick Baker's amazing painting of the American Werewolf in London.
I love it.
And
so
you got Batman versus Superman on the other cover of that. So you can go to CaptainCo.com. You can also get it, both copies and previous copies, digitally at Magzter.com, MAGZTER.com. So we'd love for you to get a subscription. You can get the current issue. You can get back issues. You can get lots of really cool
posters.
Merch. Hey, can you get any werewolves on t-shirts or posters?
We have Rick Baker's fantastic cover on t-shirts, hoodies, whatever floats your boat. We also have it as a fantastic poster. It's wonderful. I have it up on my wall.
And it's also available as a print, an exclusive print in one of our previous shock boxes as
Ooh.
Well. So that's also available on the website.
What's a shock box and how do you get it?
Well, I don't know. No, it's a monthly mystery box that Famous Monsters does, and we have all these ghoulish goodies inside. You always get an exclusive T-shirt of some sort that you can't find anywhere else, as well as it could range from toys to collectibles to comic books to stickers, all sorts of great little goodies, and you just have to sign up. You can sign up for 1 month, 3 months, or 6 months, all at CaptainCo.com.
Oh, very, very cool. We've got some good stuff.
We do.
The magazine's got good stuff. We've got some good merchandise. And you can go to our website for more content on a daily basis at famousmonsters.com. And we are all over social media. Where can you go?
Yeah, so Twitter and Instagram are going to be at FMOF. Facebook is /FMOFL. We're on Tumblr as Famous Monsters. Come find us, connect with us, comment, like, subscribe. We're also on YouTube, so you can find our YouTube channel.
For cool unboxings and other event videos, you could see our Silver Scream Fest recap there.
Oh, yeah, check it out. It's so good.
And go to Instagram and, Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, YouTube, Twitter. On Twitter, you can find me. My handle is Tiki Ambassador. Do you guys have handles on Twitter? Do you have a handle on Twitter?
I have a handle on Twitter. It's at WhereGirl48.
Wait a minute.
I think this podcast, do you guys see? Do you get the... Wait,
so there were 47 prior WhereGirls out there, and you had to get 48.
No,
she was born in 1947. Oh, wow. 48, sorry. What year were you born?
Well,
don't werewolves live a long, long, long time?
We do.
So if you're born in 1947.
I'll have to edit that out.
Now, of course, in addition to Famous Monsters, we've got all these amazing comics and American Gothic Press. A lot of great titles, including new titles coming out. What's the latest new title, and where can you find all the details on that?
Okay, we are so excited about this upcoming title. It's coming out on the 27th in your local comic book store or on CaptainCo.com. It's called Killbox by Tom Reardon and Nathan Gooden. It's just action-packed.
This one's hardcore.
Oh, my God. It's so... I can't... It's going to blow your mind. Like, ooh. Just Nathan Gooden's art in general. But we'll be talking more about that, including a conversation with Tom Reardon, the writer himself, in a couple of weeks. So your eye open on this stream. You will see an American Gothic Press podcast!
Yay! Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much for spending time with us. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoy Famous Monsters magazine, if you enjoy our comics, please spread the word. Make sure to incorporate horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and genre pop culture into your conversations to ensure generations of monster kids to come. And so, until next time, let's be transformative.
The Famous Monsters podcast is copyright Famous Monsters and Movieland Classics, LLC. All rights reserved.